This is the KPTZ Compass, your local news magazine for the Northeast Olympic Peninsula. This week on the Compass, we talk with Tibetan filmmaker Tenzing Sonam about the tragic plight of his people and homeland under Chinese occupation, and the wrenching feature film on the subject titled The Sweet Requiem he and his producing partner and wife, Ritu Sareen, recently brought to the Rose Theater. So now, let's go inside the Compass. Tenzing Sonam is a Tibetan who was born into exile, the child of refugees who fled Tibet into India with their temporal and spiritual leader Tenzin Gyatso, better known as the Dalai Lama, following an ill-fated revolt against Chinese occupation in 1959. I first met Tenzing and Ritu Sareen, the Indian woman who was to become his wife and lifelong creative partner, in the early 1980s, when Tenzing and I were both students at UC Berkeley's Graduate School of Journalism. It was there that he learned the craft of documentary filmmaking and forged his partnership with Ritu, and the two have gone on to create a string of extraordinary and moving films, both documentary and fictional, almost all of which in some way revolve around the plight of Tibet under the culture-extinguishing thumb of the Chinese. The latest of these is a feature film titled The Sweet Requiem, the wrenching story of a young girl's separation from her mother and traumatic passage across frozen mountain passes to a life in exile in Delhi, a teeming city as different from the windswept nomad's tent where she was born as fire is from ice. Tenzing and Ritu have been on tour around the world with the film this year, a tour which included a showing at Port Townsend's Rose Theater recently. I sat down with Tenzing after the showing and talked with him about the film and about the prospects for Tibetan culture. Where did the name Sweet Requiem come from, and why sweet? What is sweet about it?
The Sweet Requiem was a film that was inspired by an incident that took place on this very high mountain pass between Nepal and Tibet called the Nangpala Pass, over which many Tibetans escaped, especially in the 80s and 90s and 2000s. And in 2006, there was this particular incident where a group of Tibetans were escaping on this pass and Chinese border guards opened fire and killed a young nun. Now, this particular incident was captured on video by a Romanian mountain climber who happened to be in the vicinity, and he made this footage public. So really, for the first time, we were able to see what it was like for these Tibetans who were escaping from Tibet, crossing some of the highest mountain passes in the world, very ill-equipped to deal with the climate and the environment, but also being chased by Chinese border guards who had no hesitation in shooting them in cold blood. So having seen that footage, Ritu and me, we were kind of moved to ask a lot of questions to ourselves. Why were Tibetans still escaping from Tibet in the 90s and 2000s, nearly 40 or 50 years after the Chinese occupation? Why were so many of them young children? What happened to these kids after they came to India? So starting out from these questions, the story of the Sweet Requiem gradually evolved. And instead of a documentary film, which we initially thought we might make, it became a fictional a narrative feature. And I have to say that From the beginning, from the first instance when I started writing this script, the title just came to me. You know, it was The Sweet Requiem. And I guess it's because the film is a kind of a requiem. It's a requiem to a lost homeland. It's a requiem to people who have been left behind. For instance, in our film, Dholkar, the character, she leaves behind her family in Tibet, who she subsequently never sees again. So it's a requiem for that kind of a loss. And why sweet? I think because, requiems are songs, right, normally, and they're supposed to be sad songs, but they can also have a sweetness to their sadness. And I sometimes think maybe it should have been called the bittersweet requiem, but that would have been a mouthful and maybe not as elegant a title. So the sweet requiem just stuck as a title.
So the film starts off, I mean, it's kind of like a mystery at the beginning. You see this older Tibetan guy arrive on a bus, and he comes into a gathering of Tibetans who are all lighting candles and holding some kind of ceremony. And And there's a picture of the Dalai Lama in his room. And as there's pictures of the Dalai Lama throughout, and actually the figure of the young woman, Dulgar, you know, we see her on multiple occasions, you know, doing a little sort of prayer ceremony, like in front of a portrait of the Dalai Lama, sort of an altar. The thing that was interesting to me about that was the portrayal of Tibetans as still being very religious and very dedicated. And I was wondering about that, both about whether the Tibetans in exile are really remaining sort of true to the faith, if you want to say it that way, and also what's happening with Tibetans in Tibet, which I know is probably harder for you to know, but how central is like Buddhism and the Dalai Lama still in the lives of many Tibetans?
You know, the Dalai Lama is absolutely central to the existence of Tibetans, both inside Tibet and in exile. Of course, Tibetans see him as, you know, an incarnation of the Buddha of compassion. And as such, he is seen by most Tibetans to be almost a godlike figure. And but more than that, this present Dalai Lama has been very successful in unifying all the Tibetans, in providing a kind of leadership during a very difficult historical moment, in keeping the Tibetans together, in keeping our culture alive. And all Tibetans kind of look to him for, you know, for guidance, for inspiration, and are very devoted to him. He's a very central figure in Tibetan life. In terms of how, you know, how devout are younger Tibetans, a newer generation of Tibetans, I would say that they are still devoted to the practice of Buddhism, but perhaps not in as dedicated or as sort of an intense way as their parents were, probably. And that's, you know, to do with many different factors, living in a modern situation, being exposed to all kinds of things, not having as much time as their parents did to practice Buddhism. But as we see in the film, the kind of daily ritual of offering a prayer to the Dalai Lama or to the Buddhas, that remains kind of a kind of a tradition that
even among the younger generation,
yes. And in Tibet, of course, even though it's hard to get first-hand information out of Tibet because, you know, there's a blockade by the Chinese on any kind of news coming in or out of Tibet, we know, for instance, that most of the Tibetans who self-immolated in the 2000s, nearly 155 of them, their chief demand was the return of the Dalai Lama to Tibet. That was one of the two demands they made, the other being greater freedom for Tibetans.
What conditions has His Holiness laid down for his return? Would he go back under certain circumstances?
Absolutely. Since the 80s, His Holiness the Dalai Lama has kind of shifted the entire kind of goal of the Tibetan struggle, which until then was fighting for independence for Tibet, basically wanting the Chinese to leave Tibet. But from the 80s onwards, the Dalai Lama has shifted his position and kind of instituted what he calls the middle way approach, in which he says, I'm no longer asking for independence for Tibet. I'm content that Tibet remains a part of China. All I'm asking for is greater freedom within Tibet for Tibetans to control our culture, our language, our religion. And that's all he's asking for. Unfortunately, the Chinese have not responded in kind and see that as a kind of a disguised demand for independence. That's what they accuse the middle way approach as being. So at the moment, there's a kind of a deadlock because the Chinese are just totally unwilling to hold any kind of dialogue with the Dalai Lama. But His Holiness himself has often expressed the desire to go back to Tibet. And if the situation in Tibet kind of lightens up a bit, if the Chinese show some kind of accommodation to you know, what he's asking for, I think he would be really happy to go back to Tibet.
But it sounds to me from the things that I heard you saying after the screening the other day that things are really going quite in the opposite direction in Tibet. I was very saddened to hear, for example, that Tibetans are no longer learning Tibetan in school. It reminds me of sort of the policies that were carried out in the United States and other Western countries regarding their indigenous peoples.
Absolutely. This is one reason why many of us believe in exile, that the Chinese government, which is the Communist Party of China, is not willing to negotiate with the Dalai Lama, simply because it feels that it can take care of the Tibetan situation by gradually destroying Tibetan culture, Tibetan identity, making Tibetans a minority in their own country, and effectively just sort of making sure that they're completely unimportant. And the Chinese have instituted policies to make that a reality. For instance, in the last few years, the study of Tibetan at the primary school level, which was still possible in Tibet until a few years ago, has gradually been shut down. So even at the primary level, to get a Tibetan education is becoming almost impossible inside Tibet. At the at the high school kind of level, it was always difficult for Tibetans to get a Tibetan education, and now it's almost impossible. So most Tibetans in Tibet, in order to kind of get on with their lives, to get jobs, to kind of integrate into the society, have to study Chinese. And that's, of course, one effective way of destroying their identity. The practice of Buddhism, which China sees as one of the greatest threats to its control over the Tibetans, they're targeting that also in many different ways, but primarily in controlling the monasteries in Tibet, the numbers of monks that can be enrolled, stationing work teams, Communist Party work teams within the monasteries to monitor exactly what the monks are studying, what they're doing, to have intensive campaigns in these monasteries called patriotic re-education campaigns, where the sole purpose of this campaign is for the monks to denounce the Dalai Lama and to learn to offer their pledges to the Communist Party of China. So these things are actively going on. Then you have the nomadic kind of tradition in Tibet, which constitutes a large percentage of the population. The Chinese have slowly dismantled the nomadic tradition by forcing nomads to relocate to government settlements. And these are usually concrete settlements on the edges of towns where the nomads, once they are sent there, I mean, they become like Native Americans in their reservations in Arizona or, New Mexico or wherever we see them in the U.S. Very similar situation. And this is being done under the justification that it's for environmental preservation, which is really ironic, because these nomads have been the stewards of, the high mountain pastures in Tibet for millennia. And suddenly they're the ones who, the pastures have to be protected from them. So in all these different ways, the Chinese have really stepped up control inside Tibet. They're also controlling the movement of Tibetans within the country. So it's really, really ironic that any Han Chinese citizen in China with a Han Chinese identity certificate or identity card can travel freely inside Tibet wherever they want. But Tibetans within Tibet are not able to go from one place to another without all kinds of formalities, documents, permits that they need. So even this movement of Tibetans, because they see that as being dangerous, large numbers of Tibetans congregate in Lhasa, for instance, and then, they rise up against the Chinese. So to control that kind of threat, they've just simply made it almost impossible for Tibetans to move within the country.
In the film, you portray the ways, and actually after the film, you talked about those self-immolations, and you told us the reason why that has really declined, and it's not out of a lack of the same kind of anguish that caused it in the first place. But why don't you talk a little bit about why the self-immolations have ceased in recent years?
So really, the first self-immolation in Tibet happened in February of 2009. And I should go back a little bit in history to the year prior to that, which is 2008, which was the year of the Beijing Olympics. But it was also the year when there was a massive uprising all over the Tibetan plateau that took place, a series of demonstrations, protests that momentarily was on the international media.
No, I remember that.
But then it all too quickly died down. And before we knew it, the Olympics were successfully staged and the world forgot about Tibet. But what the Chinese did, and they did not forget that in the lead up to the Olympics, their big coming out party, the Tibetans embarrassed them by, staging these protests and demonstrations, by disrupting the torch relay that took place in several cities around the world. So what they did was they cracked down really hard in Tibet after 2008. thousands of Tibetans were arrested in the months after the Olympics. People who were seen to have participated in this protest, many of them just disappeared. For the first time, artists, poets, writers, musicians were all arrested, locked up, sent to prison for 5-6 years, tortured in prison. I mean, the situation in Tibet became really, really bad. And the possibility any longer of protesting as they had done in 2008 suddenly became impossible. And it was in this climate that the first self-immolation took place, really as a, I suppose you could say it was a desperate measure in which one was protesting with the sacrifice of one's own life in the most horrific kind of way possible, burning yourself in public. And because there was no resort to any other way of protesting. And that first self-immolation in 2009 led to a spate of self-immolations all across the Tibetan plateau. So in 2010, 2011, even in 2012, there were several self-immolations happening, sometimes one or two every day. And that's the period that our film, The Sweet Requiem, is set in.
Right. And we see some Tibetans in exile watching videos of Tibetan monk dousing himself with gasoline and just all in flame. And it's a shocking image.
Yes. And in the early days of the self-immolations, Tibetans inside Tibet were able to take video footage, still footage, and send it out to us in exile. And we were then able to, publicize them. But very soon, the Chinese realized that this was completely getting out of hand. So they cracked down on the self-immolation movement, mainly by targeting the families of the self-immolators. So they made it a crime, not just for the self-immolator, but for his close family. So, if somebody in your family self-immolated, the family would be held responsible for that person's death, and they would be prosecuted, put into prison. That proved to be quite a strong deterrent, because, of course, the self-immolators were self-immolating because they were sacrificing their own lives. But if that meant that their families and their near and dear ones were going to be impacted, then obviously, they would think twice, right? So that ensured that the self-immolations died out. Although even this year, we've had about 3 self-immolations. The other thing that happened was the Chinese cracked down hard on the exchange of information via cell phones, via the internet. I mean, really came down heavily on surveilling that kind of activity. And so that ensured that no more video footage, no more images of self-immolations came out of Tibet, which also then, the whole point of these self-immolations was to try and raise public awareness around the world. And suddenly, there were no images coming out of Tibet showing that, then, that sacrifice kind of just disappeared.
And that was a sort of horrifying use of power that you portrayed in other ways in the movie, too. So that older Tibetan I mentioned, like we see him arriving on a bus, and he turns out to have actually been the guide who somewhat reluctantly had helped Dholkar escape from Tibet. And some horrifying thing, I mean, like some people are shot by Chinese soldiers and so on. Well, that guide has now become something of a political activist, and he's bringing information out of Tibet. And we see him being interviewed by a couple of Chinese spies. I mean, they're actually Tibetans who are spying for the Chinese, and they threaten him with charging his wife and throwing her into prison and accusing her of crimes and possibly executing her if he doesn't do as they say. I mean, this is based on true stories, or did you put those sorts of things in for dramatic effect?
No, I mean, there's no question that this form of intimidation by the Chinese government is widespread, not just among the exiled Tibetan community, but today among the Uyghur exile community. There are many stories of Uyghur activists who've been approached and threatened by Chinese operatives, saying that their families back in in Xinjiang would suffer if they continued. And not only that, where their families have been arrested Uyghurs or Tibetans, but even Chinese dissidents have the same thing happening to them. In fact, we showed this film in New York, and we had a Q&A session that was moderated by a Chinese dissident who was a former protester in the Tiananmen Square uprising. And she just told us that even she, living in New York, had been approached by Chinese underground Chinese people telling her that she should watch out what she does and says, because just remember, you know, you have people back in China. So this is something that is a very common kind of occurrence. We know of a case of a Tibetan activist in Nepal who was a former political prisoner in Tibet, escaped after he was released from prison, and continued to work in Nepal as a researcher for a human rights organization. I believe it was Amnesty or Human Rights Watch. And he was approached by a Tibetan who gently told him, again, you know, if you don't stop what you're doing, your family is back in Tibet. And subsequently, he did stop. So, I mean, yeah, it does happen. It happens a lot.
So the film is sort of set around 2010 or 11, something like that.
That's right, would you say?
Yeah. But you say that now that exodus of Tibetans across the mountains has all but dried up. And could you talk a little bit about why that's happened?
You know, the year 2008, again, is kind of a watershed year. It was after 2008 that the Chinese decided that they had to really tighten up the border kind of controls to, you know, have like really high-tech surveillance along the Himalayan border. I mean, using drone technology, using CCTV camera technology to prevent Tibetans from leaving Tibet. They also, targeted families of Tibetans who escaped to Tibet, holding them responsible for their family members who'd escaped Tibet. So that also proved to be a strong deterrent. But basically from 2008 onwards until the present day, the numbers of Tibetans who are escaping from Tibet has just literally come to a standstill. I think this year, maybe about 25 or 30 Tibetans have escaped from Tibet. During the 80s, 90s, and 2000s, we were seeing at an average about 2,000 to 3,000 Tibetans escaping every year. So that's completely come to a stop.
The whole situation just looks pretty dire for Tibetan culture. And one of the things that you know, like I can't help but wonder about is right now the Dalai Lama is this kind of glue, as you were saying before, is holding the culture together and this figure that the Tibetans all look up to. But what happens when he dies?
Mm-hmm. This is something that is really, really concerning. And I think within the Tibetan community, we are not thinking enough about this scenario, simply because no one wants to think of a time when the Dalai Lama will no longer be there. And it's almost considered to be inauspicious to even discuss a scenario where he might not be there. So we're not paying enough attention to what is actually going to be a critical situation when he's no longer there. First and foremost, the Chinese have already put into place certain regulations that allow the Chinese government, the Communist Party of China, to decide on reincarnate lamas in Tibetan Buddhism. So in other words, traditionally what used to be in the realm of just Tibetan Buddhist practitioners, you know, in how a reincarnate lama was recognized, now the reincarnate lama has to be officially approved by the Chinese state before they can be legitimate in the eyes of the Chinese government. So this is a law that they have passed. They have also set precedents where they have selected their own reincarnate lama, as in the case of the Panchen Lama, who is one of the highest lamas in Tibet after the Dalai Lama. The young child that the Dalai Lama had recognized from exile in India was abducted, disappeared, him and his entire family. This was in 1995 and hasn't been seen or heard of since. And instead, the Chinese, they put forward their own, you know, young boy and proclaimed him to be the Panchen Lama. And that unfortunate child is today in his 20s or 30s, is the so-called official Panchen Lama. But no Tibetan has any faith in him or respects him. In fact, we know him as the fake Panchen. But what this implies is that in the time when His Holiness is no longer there, the Chinese will certainly come up with their own Dalai Lama in Tibet. And in exile, I think the exiled Tibetan community will find our own Dalai Lama according to, you know, time-honored traditions, and we will believe him to be the real Dalai Lama. So effectively, there'll be two Dalai Lamas in the world. But without the present Dalai Lama's incredible leadership and, you know, the force to cohere the whole Tibetan movement and the Tibetan people, I think things will get really bad, because there are many different competing visions of how the Tibetan struggle should be pushed forward all the way from launching a violent kind of struggle, which has completely not been the case because the Dalai Lama is so completely, for nonviolence, to rejecting the middle way approach of the Dalai Lama completely, wanting independence again. I mean, we could see all kinds of competing interests and goals, and that's going to, again, break up the solidarity of the Tibetan movement. So we'll go through a period of quite a lot of chaos at that time. That's my personal opinion.
What do you hope for the film? What do you hope the world's response will be to seeing your film?
Of course, the main hope that Ritu and I have is that the film will be able to be seen widely, and that it will remind audiences around the world again that Tibet is not a dead issue, that the suffering of the Tibetan people continues, that the situation in Tibet remains grim, and that, you know, we need attention. But of course, what we've seen over the years, particularly in the last maybe 5 or 10 years, is that as China becomes ever more powerful economically and militarily and is able to flex its muscles on a whole range of, you know, issues, not just politics, but even in the cultural sphere. I mean, China's trying to present its own narrative on all these matters. And at the same time, it's trying its best to narrow or even shut down completely the space for alternative viewpoints or alternative narratives, including, you know, films like ours. And the sad reality is that, you know, a lot of institutions are acquiescing to this Chinese pressure, largely to do with the economic kind of pressure that it comes with, and just choosing to self-censor and voluntarily shutting down space for these alternative forms of narratives. And that is really worrying. I mean, just to give you a small example, the Cambridge University Press in England has a journal called the China Quarterly, which is, you know, a highly regarded academic journal in Chinese studies. They wanted to, you know, launch a digital edition of the China Quarterly in China for Chinese users, but were told by the Chinese government that in order to gain access to that market, they would have to excise about 300 odd articles that had to do with Tiananmen Square, that had to do with Tibet, about the Falun Gong. In short, anything that the Chinese government doesn't like. And Cambridge University Press agreed. So they launched an edition of China Quarterly in China without these articles. Luckily, the academic community rose up, were outraged and forced Cambridge University Press to withdraw. But it just goes to show you that how deep this form of self-censorship is, that even organizations or institutions that you would think would be standing up for, you know, values that we just take for granted are ready to sacrifice them, for economic gain.
The Sweet Requiem has its own Facebook page where information about viewing opportunities can be found. With filmmaker Tenzing Sonam, this is Steve Evans for KPTZ Community Radio News. This week's Compass was written and produced by Steve Evans. The Compass airs Mondays at noon and 5 p.m. and repeats the following Saturday at noon. You can listen to podcasts of past Compass programs at the kptz.org website, where you can also stream KPTZ live 24 hours a day. For the news team here at KPTZ 91.9 FM in Port Townsend, I'm Steve Evans. ¶¶